We thought we would have a joint hearing of the Senate Tax and the Senate Finance Committees to discuss the new forecast. Obviously, we, for a couple of purposes. One, thought it would be useful to have a combined conversation of these issues. And second, obviously, with the three gentlemen, we've got lots to do other than maybe just bounce around from committee to committee with some of the same discussions. So we thought it would be helpful to the three of you. So, Commissioner and Director Stinson and Director Showalter. I think, members, you've got the forecast budget slides. You've got the highlights from the forecast from yesterday. And some other materials. So, Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I don't think I've seen this many chairs around the table in this room before. I've had them this empty, but thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the courtesy to present the forecast, and thank you for the joint hearing. We have provided you with the slide presentation as well as the summary of the forecast, which we will be referring to. If you look at the bottom of the first page, it shows you the number that we all already know and heard yesterday, $994 million. And it's also, as Mr. Showalter will show you in a minute, it's a $5.8 billion tail in 12 and 13. If you look on the on page 2, the two slides gives you two different pictures. The top of the page shows you the February forecast compared to the November forecast, and then the bottom of the page shows you the February forecast compared to the end of session estimates, essentially the beginning of the biennium. If you look at the top of the page, the two numbers that changed in the forecast, the revenues are, Mr. Chairman, $25 million to the good. That's a net number. Our corporate tax number was $127 million up, and then that was netted down by some decreases in the income tax and other taxes. And Dr. Stinson will talk about that in a moment. But the big change in the forecast is the $184 million in spending changes, primarily from human services to the good, that resulted in our $209 million to the positive. But I want to show you at the bottom of the page before I turn it over to Dr. Stinson that it's important to keep in perspective not just the time period from November to November to February, but back to the end of last session and the start of the biennium. And in that case, it's a 3.6% decline in revenues. That means we still have a billion-dollar challenge in our state. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson.
Dr. Stinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the commissioners noted, and as we noted yesterday, it's really only a very small change in the revenue forecast. This is actually the smallest change in the revenue forecast that I can remember from a November to a February period. The reason why is the story still the same as it was in November. The income tax is the largest component of this. It amounts to $874 million, but actually, if you take into account the change in the treatment of reciprocity, which was a separate item in the other revenues, that puts it at roughly $1 billion difference. The reason why revenues are down from this time last year and end of session estimates is because wages were weaker than we thought they were going to be as a function of the severity of the Great Recession. The reason why the revenues haven't changed much since November is because the forecast, the national economic forecast, hasn't changed very much as well. If you look at the bottom of page 3, normally, I would give you a graph that shows the GDP, projected GDP for February versus the forecast for GDP growth in that we used in November. Here, because the differences are so slight, what I'm doing instead is showing you the alternatives. The real debate in economic circles now is what the shape of the recovery is going to be. There are some people who believe that we are going to have a double-dip recession, the so-called W recovery, where you go up and then this summer we turn back down again and then we turn back up again after a while. That's the bottom bottom line on the graph, the small dotted line. Global Insight has a scenario with a W recession in it. It's assigned a probability of 15%. The heavy black line is the baseline scenario. That's the U-shaped recovery, the long, slow recovery that you've heard us talk about for more than a year, actually more than a year and a half, I think. We've talked about the recovery being more U-shaped. That's given a probability of 65%. And then the large dashed line that's above it, the more optimistic scenario, that's the V-shaped recovery that you read about in the financial press some, and that some people are forecasting. Global Insight gives that a probability of 25%. This is the V-shaped recovery will give us much more rapid economic growth. In 2010, we would have 4.3% annual growth rate compared to the 3% in the U-shaped recovery. In 2011, we'd have 4.2% growth instead of 2.8% growth. That gets the economy back to the place where we started the recession faster, and it increases the amount of production in the economy faster going on out. But if you turn to the top, page 4, you can see that those gains, while important in terms of national income and product and production, don't translate into quick recovery in jobs. It takes until 2013 for the economy to get back to where it was in terms of employment under the baseline scenario. Under the more optimistic V-shaped recovery, it still takes until 2012, middle of 2012, before we get back to the same level of jobs as we had before. And, of course, given that the workforce, the labor force, has grown over the past few years and will have grown over the 5 years between the start of the recession and the end of the recovery phase in jobs, the unemployment rate is still going to be high. If you look at the bottom graph on page 4, you can see the result there. The dark area behind is total payroll employment in the U.S., and you can see that it reaches the 2007 high in 2013, but the unemployment rate still will be above 8% at that point. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the economic discussion that we have. Let me turn it over to Mr. Showalter to talk about the expenditure side.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. I'll walk you through the other half or other piece of the forecast, which is the spending changes that are included in this forecast. If you look at the next slide, you'll see a summary of all of the changes totaling $184 million in this current biennium. That's a relatively small change in the spending side, but nonetheless is the most of the change that you see in this updated forecast information. By area, you'll see a small decrease in K-12 spending, mostly driven by slightly lower than projected pupil counts, offset by higher than anticipated poverty concentration that leads to some compensatory ed changes. Property tax aids and credits down somewhat. That is really driven by lower than anticipated property tax refunds. And health and human services, $150 million change is the largest share of these spending changes. Roughly $83 million of that was already known about a week ago. And it's really driven by the Secretary of Health and Human Services from the federal level, who announced that she would broaden the basis on which enhanced federal matching funds would be available. Because of that broader basis, the state has a lower cost to what's known as clawback payments for Medicare Part D. And that saves the state's general fund $82.9 million during this forecast period. That money is one time. It is not an ongoing revenue source, but it does lower the projected cost for health and human services during this biennium. Beyond that, there are some more modest programmatic changes, slightly lower than anticipated nursing facility enrollment, payment changes or payment costs for some of these programs, as well as lower than anticipated chemical dependency costs. Altogether, as I said, about $184 million reduction. Continuing on to the next slide, although we have somewhat lower spending in the current biennium, that change is not carried out into 12 and 13. You'll see here that actually the February forecast shows $51 million higher spending anticipated for 2012 and 13, and revenues $312 million lower than previously forecast. So both are really rather modest for planning estimate purposes, but nonetheless, that leads us to a higher 12 and 13 gap, moving from $5.4 billion to $5.8 billion. As with the November forecast, there are some major assumptions that are built into that. Those are itemized below. And also, as with past presentations, discretionary inflation is not included in that figure, but is stated there quite clearly at $1.181 billion. That overall picture is a tricky one and a difficult one to understand, and so we just included one more slide to help articulate some of the trends that are going on that lead us to that place. The final slide for in this presentation just shows you general fund spending as you see it in the fund balance, growing from about $33.9 billion to $31.1 billion and then up to $38.7 billion. A somewhat confusing picture. It's like, wow, it's going down $2 billion and then up nearly $7 billion. What's happening is that the federal stimulus dollars are allowing the state to not spend for Medicaid, for some of the programs that are funded by state stabilization dollars. You see the impact of that on the next line and then the combined spending after taking that into account. Beyond that, there's also one-time savings due to payment shifts in the education area and in the repayment of some of those shifts in 12 and 13. So you've got several different points of comparison. I think the bottom line here, and I just bring for the committee's reference, is that there is still underlying spending growth and that there are significant one-time resources in 10 and 11 that help us to balance the picture but aren't available again in 12 and 13. So beneath it all is, I think, a need to address those structural issues and try to find some way to address those. With that, the overall picture of this forecast, very similar to what was presented in November. And I think we're open to any questions that you might have.
Mr. Showalter, does the slight improvement in the current biennium, does that have any impact on the state's cash flow situation this spring? We talked about March, April, potentially having to borrow money from schools to cash flow. Does this have any impact on state cash flow in the short run here?
Mr. Chair, not really. The improvement from the federal payments, that clawback payments, is going to be metered out over a period of months. So it will not be, as I'd initially hoped, maybe an $81 million or $83 million check coming into the state. So we're not anticipating any significant change in the spring's cash flow picture. From the data that we've had on a day-by-day basis, we are tracking our forecasted numbers very closely.
Mr. Showalter, are we borrowing money yet, or are we still paying our own bills?
Mr. Chair, we are still paying our own bills.
Mr. Chairman, as we discussed in the LAC meeting in January, we put out an RFP, a request for proposals, on short-term borrowing, and if we ever are going to flip the switch, we're going to come back to the LAC and discuss what we've discovered as far as the proposals. So you'll be one of the first to know.
Any other questions, members? Dr. Stinson, if employment is improving, why are income tax collections still going down? I mean, and significantly, I mean, $1 billion from what was previously forecasted, lower. I mean, we read that January jobs ticked up. Why are our income tax numbers still going trending the other direction?
Mr. Chairman, the $1 billion number that I cited is compared to what we forecast last year at this time. And basically what happened is that wages grew more slowly, total wages, not wages per hour or wages per job, but total wages, combination of fewer jobs and fewer hours worked per job, that those things were weaker than we expected last February at this time. The recovery is just about on track with what we were forecasting earlier. It's just that we're coming from a deeper position. We have weaker wages. Now, we also took capital gains down slightly in there, but most of the story is in the wages.
And on the corporate side?
Corporate side, the short story is that we were just too conservative in our estimate of refunds, and the reason why we were more conservative in our estimate of refunds is that the Department of Revenue was getting ready to make conversion of the corporate taxes to their gen tax system, and we weren't sure how fast they had accelerated the processing of corporate refunds. So we took a conservative position, knowing that we could always improve it here in this forecast.
It was a short
Showalter,
presentation.
It was pretty abbreviated, but
Dr. Stinson said, it's very similar. The national forecast hasn't changed, so that's why our
Senator Pogomar.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner and Mr. Stinson, I was looking at page 5. Chart at the bottom of the page there seems to indicate that revenues are down $1.1 billion. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then if you look at page 6, that chart, it seems to indicate that spending is down $184 million. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Yes.
So if someone were to characterize, Commissioner, we've gone through this before, remember last year? So
yes.
If someone were to characterize what the challenge is here, it appears that the challenge is lack of revenue rather than, it appears that you and your governor have been pretty good at holding down spending. Can I give you credit for that? Can I give you credit for holding down spending?
I'll take any credit you give me, Senator.
So you would agree that $184 million of spending less is a good thing from your perspective?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogomiller, I think it's pretty tough not to look at this forecast and draw the conclusion that, in fact, we have it on our presentations. We have it prominently in the packet that we're down $1.1 billion, that there's a that our revenue has declined.
Revenue shortfall.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on page 7, that chart in the and I appreciate the I think the presentation on inflation has been better in the last several, and I appreciate that. I think the department's been doing a good job on that, because you can add those numbers up pretty quick. But what I was most interested in is the second footnote, no repayment of the K-12 property tax recognition shift. Repayment would cost $564. So this is now another indication that there's been a $564 million one-time cut to education. Is that the correct way to see that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, you and I have discussed this at length. Our view is that the governor's unallotment mimicked the shift, not going forward, and we don't see that as a one-time cut. The actual effect of it is a one-time cut to the schools.
Okay, Commissioner, what I'm asking, though, is does the governor anticipate that there will be no repayment of that 564, or does he anticipate that there will be a repayment of the 564?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, the last time we did the shift in 2002 and 2003, it was repaid fairly quickly and now is available. I don't think the shift will get paid back in the next year, but because we have the repayment in the budget reserve statute, I think that at some point when we return to surpluses that will get repaid. Budget reserve.
No, Commissioner, I'm not trying to anticipate some possibility. I'm asking what is the governor's position. Does he assume that 564 will get paid back? Because if he does, then we need to add that to the 5.7. If, on the other hand, that's being written off, which is what I believe the position is of the executive branch, then that 5.7 is the accurate number. And I'm just asking which way, and just pick one.
We're shifting it out.
The 1.1 you're shifting out. The 564 you're writing off, I believe.
No, we're shifting them both out into the future, the shift has always worked.
Okay, well then, Commissioner, shouldn't the 564 show up in the 5.7 then? Shouldn't it be added to that?
We have the authority to shift that out.
Well, I'm just asking where the 5.7, you should add the 564. And I think Mr. Showalter is shaking his head yes. I mean, the math works one way or the other. If you intend on somebody paying that back someday, then you have to add the 564. If you don't intend on that being paid back, then you don't add the 564. Because the 1.1 is in the 5.7. The 1.1 is in the 5.7. The 564 is not.
The payback is not necessarily time-specific, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pogemiller. That's why it doesn't show up.
It doesn't make a difference when the payback is. It's either something that's on the books or it's not on the books.
Commissioner, is the requirement in law to pay back the shift after the budget reserve and the cash flow account are refilled and then the shift gets paid back? Is it a requirement to pay back the aid shift or the property tax recognition shift or both?
It's both.
Both?
Yes. And the airport fund's in there too, Mr. Chairman. I want you to know that.
So, Mr. Chair, to clarify, the shifts or payment delays that were made either through administrative actions or through an allotment aren't legislative changes subject to those forecast replenishments that you're referring to. If they were adopted by the legislature, then they would be subject to replenishment or reversal if there's a surplus in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner. That's actually not true. Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Senator Tomasoni, then we'll go back. Go ahead. Senator Pogemiller.
I don't think there is any automatic repayment back of any circumstance. There's no statutory authority for that now because that was not done under statutory authority. It was done under a accounting change. So there's no, you can't have it both ways. All I'm asking you to do is to pick which way you want it. Keep your storyline consistent and then let us debate the storyline. And you can't say it's on both sides of the story. It's one or the other. And this is now the second or third document that has shown that at least the governor thinks, and you think, Commissioner, that 1.1 is going to be paid back, but the 564 is not going to be paid back. That's what the documents keep showing. And so when I ask you to verify that, you tell me, oh, no, that's going to be paid back. Well, one, there's no legal authority for it to be paid back because it was not done under statute. It was done under just a gimmick by the department. And secondly, your own documents don't include it as ever being paid back. And I'm not trying to be difficult. I can work the other way. If you want to say it's going to be paid back, then I want to put the 564 onto the 5.7. And, Commissioner, I'm just asking you, which way do you want it?
Well, Mr.
And then you should have your documents consistent with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, that's why we, in the governor's supplemental budget recommendations, we are asking for the shift to be ratified so that it will get paid back and that statute is operative.
Okay, well, we have not seen that language yet.
Well, I think
do we have that bill yet?
Yes. It's in the unallotment ratification bill, and then the jackets were brought over, I think, late yesterday for the K-12 bill.
Okay. Well, we'll take a look at the bills. Okay.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you just mentioned the $15 million for the airport fund is in the projections here. We have a couple of airport projects in the bonding bill, and some people are suggesting that if we fund these airport projects that that'll count as payback for the airport debt. Is that your understanding also?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I think
if we ever have a bonding bill, go ahead.
Well, with you on the conference committee, I'm sure.
I appreciate that.
I think it was the 2006 or 7 session. We utilized a excess balance. If you probably remember
that
in the airport fund, and I think it was the last session, put them in line behind the budget reserve and the repayment shift to repay that $15 million. That was last session. Since then, they have received, I know they've received some federal money through the ARRA legislation, and they've had the ability to move forward with projects in that through that fund.
So is that a yes? Was that a yes? That if those airport projects are funded through the through bonding projects, that they'll be...
Well, and then there's bonding projects, too. And I'm assuming the bonding projects come forward if they don't get the funding in the airport fund. And the airport fund is generally for safety improvements on the runway, lighting, and those type of things. And I know the, I think that's the Virginia, I'm trying to remember, the Virginia airport?
Chisholm-Hibbing. It's now called the Range Regional Airport.
Is it? Okay. Okay. And then the Duluth, they're talking, some of those projects are a little larger and are more terminal, like moving the terminals. So I think that's why they're in the bonding bill and not getting money out of the airport fund.
So would they be credited back toward the $15 million debt?
No, there's no relation.
Okay, and my second question is, and I don't know if this is for you, Commissioner, or for Dr. Stinson, but also on page 5, there's a little narrative up in the second, the first paragraph on the page talks about 2/3 of the jobs lost in this state over the past 2 years have been in 3 industries, manufacturing, construction, and retail trade. And, construction seems to be something that we hear a real lot about, and especially in this legislative session, considering that we have a bonding bill coming up and something that we're trying to get done in a hurry so that we can get people back to work. I know that you've said that the bonding bill will maybe not have an immediate effect on the numbers on the economy, but that people's going back to work will have a, you know, have a significant effect on people going back to work. So can you comment on that, and can you comment on the last line that says many laid off construction and manufacture workers will need to retrain for work in other sectors where demand for workers is growing more rapidly? Where are those sectors, and how long will that retraining take, and how long will it take to get those people back to work if they do decide to retrain?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, let me discuss the construction outlook first, I guess.
Dr. Stinson, would you pull the microphone closer, sure, please?
In the last 2 years, we've lost about 27,000 construction jobs. We anticipate that we will add about 10,000 construction jobs back over the next 2 years. There's always a margin of error in the forecast, and you know it could be a little bit more, but it also could be a little bit less. Moving the accelerating passage of the capital budget will make a little bit of difference, but it won't make 17,000 jobs difference. Slowing it down is going to make a little bit of difference, but it's not going to make 10,000 jobs difference or anything like that. So really what we face is we face a situation where there are 17,000 construction jobs that aren't going to be replaced in the next 2 years. And that's the concern that we have. Some of these people are not ever going to regain their construction employment. They're going to have to find jobs in other places and in other sectors. And matching the skill set of somebody that's trained in the construction area somebody that's trained in the construction area into some other area can be difficult, and so there's a real question as to how this mismatch of skills and demands for skills is going to be remedied, and how to remedy it in the most rapid manner that we can. That's a responsibility that the Department of Employment and Economic Development has. Their job skills centers and things like that. That's a responsibility that is going to be needed. There's going to be needed coordination with MNSCU activities to train people for positions that are going to be that there's going to be an increased demand for in the future. And this is really a crucial part of this recovery, and it's something that we wanted to highlight in the forecast book, and we actually talk about it several places further on in the book as well as in here, because that's really going to be the key to longer-term growth in this state, is how successful we are at providing the training that's needed for people to make the transition from construction employment or manufacturing employment into other occupations. Clearly, we don't want to be in a situation where we train a whole lot of people to be X-ray technicians, because that's a place where we think that there's going to be growth, and then find out that we've trained too many people to be X-ray technicians, and they don't have jobs in that position as well. And so this is just a real critical part of the recovery that needs to be paid attention to by the state.
Maybe I could ask the chairman, Senator Bach, if any of his carpenters who are on the bench are seeking retraining as X-ray technicians or some other sector of the economy, because I think that most of these construction workers, they stick around to be construction workers for as long as they possibly can. And I know that you've said before that the MNSCU part of the budget and the HEPRA is probably one of the places where we get people back to work in a hurry. And one of the reasons we're trying to get the bonding bill out the door is to put all 27,000 people back to work that this bonding bill might result in. And when I see a narrative in the forecast that says construction is a huge part of why we have a deficit, it seems to me we got to do whatever we can to get people back to work. And in this particular session, I think a good-sized bonding bill is probably part of the answer. But that's my opinion, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman.
Commissioner, our very competent Senate staff tells me that the repayment provisions in 16A, where the school shift gets paid back after the budget reserve is full and after the cash flow account is restored, that the current law in 16A does not provide for repayment of the property tax recognition shift, just to the age shift. So what I guess we need to see the language in the governor's K-12 proposal, but if it's not going to be characterized as a cut, if it's codified, I think we may have to look at the language. But there's still a lot of confusion about whether this school payment delay or shift is a cut or is not a cut. And it tell me if I'm wrong, Mr. Showalter, if the $1.1 billion, the aid shift, delay, whatever we want to call it, if that doesn't automatically get repaid in law, if the legislature has to at some point in the future appropriate that money, a future legislature has to appropriate it before schools are going to get it, doesn't that under current law make it a cut? I mean, if there's no provision in law for it to be automatically repaid and a future legislature actually has to appropriate that 1.1, wouldn't somebody like me think today that it's a cut if the only way it gets restored is if a future legislature actually appropriates the money? Wouldn't I think of it as a cut?
Mr. Chair, good question. The 12 and 13 budget obviously hasn't been acted upon, but the legislature is going to have to act on all of the figures that are shown here. And so the planning estimates, the 12 and 13 numbers here, just as in the past, are really that, just planning estimates, trying to anticipate the current law projections of obligations. In this instance, it gets foggy. And that's why we're trying to provide more than our usual amount of information on this. There's certainly plenty of questions about future growth in human services, changes in aids and credits, all of those things. This one is particularly dicey because of the payment shifts and the long-term implications of them. On the aid payment shift, essentially what's happening is that the state will be paying less in cash to school districts for entitlements in this current biennium. There's a settle up because those entitlements haven't been changed. How the legislature deals with that in fiscal year 12 is obviously undetermined until the legislature comes to deal with that in fiscal year 12. The assumptions underlying this forecast are that the unallotment authority for changing the payment rate essentially will go back to its current law status, and that there's going to be some obligation to pay that former entitlement. That's why you see the increase of roughly $1.2 billion in spending in 12 related to that shift. Yeah. The perception of that from a legislative standpoint, very valid, but those are the assumptions that we have to work through because we can't see into the eyes of what the 2012 and 13 budget is going to look like. We can only tell you some of the issues that you're going to be facing in that biennium.
Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up, we've had this discussion for months over the this issue. I haven't seen – I'm wondering why, if you think it's a cut, why the ed orgs want us to support ratification of the shift. I've missed somewhere the signs coming to the Capitol opposing this. Nobody is considering this a cut in the broader public. I don't follow education issues every day. Dr. Melcher's here, but I it seems that people want this ratified from what I can tell.
Senator Metzen.
Well, thank you. I was getting back to Senator Tomasoni's remarks about this retraining and the talking about the construction jobs. I'm sure you've considered the major a major bonding bill, and obviously about $600 million of the billion is workers, taxpaying workers. And also there's an initiative that Senator Bach and to some degree I'm working on, a major job stimulus bill. So I can't see how it'd be so dismal in terms of the construction workers if those two major bills go forward. And I know we have a lot of Republican support on the jobs bill and even the bonding bill. So and those numbers are still going to be that bad in the construction area? I mean, these are major initiatives, and I wouldn't think the numbers would be that bad.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, we're going to add, we think we will add 10,000 jobs in construction. No, in total, over the next 2 years in construction. Okay. But we've lost 27,000. Assume we're 50% wrong, that we're off by 50% and we add 15,000. That still means that we will have 12,000 people who have, or 12,000 construction jobs that no longer exist. Now, some of that may be, some of the people that have lost those jobs may be able to filter into jobs that are opened by people that are retiring, you know, because they've gotten older. But no matter what, there's going to be a need for retraining some of those construction workers. Similarly, on the manufacturing side, we've lost 52,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 2 years. Now, that's a better record on a percentage basis than the national economy. But over the next 2 years, we think we're only going to add about 26,000 manufacturing jobs. This retraining, this skills mismatch situation is an important issue that's going to have to be dealt with. You know, it's important to get capital budgets and all the direct employment stimulation that you can going on, but there is going to be a skills mismatch where the new jobs are and what the training of the individuals are. That's part of what happens in a recession, and that's something that we need to be prepared for and preparing ourselves so that we have a stronger economic situation looking out.
I can understand that to some degree the manufacturing part of it, but I would think the construction thing with the initiatives that we have going wouldn't be that bad, but we'll see.
Dr. Stinson, let me follow up on that. You've talked about the fact that the combination of manufacturing, construction, retail trade will only come back to the extent of maybe 25% of jobs we've had at the peak. Is there any kind of historic parallel in American economic history where there's been some major economic displacement and the recovery has also been coupled with a significant change in available employment? I'm trying to think of whether the Depression or the 1890 situation. I mean, where there had to be a total shift in the employment of the country and what the result of that was and if it was successful.
Mr. Chairman, in the 1980-81-82 recession, which some of you probably remember the situation in the Iron Range about what happened to iron mining employment during that time. We had an enormous downward shift in production of taconite. We had an enormous downward shift in the employment in production of taconite. Since that time, the production of taconite's actually gone up and exceeds the levels that we had prior to the recession in the 1980s, but the employment has never recovered because of productivity. And so those productivity changes are what's important, that we have people making more per hour, making more units, of producing more units of goods per hour in there. That's part of a kind of a natural progression. That's what we've seen.
But in that instance, you're suggesting that the employment came back, that taconite mine is at a higher level.
No, I'm not. The production came back.
Okay, but the jobs did not come back.
But the jobs did not come back.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, it had a lot to do with bigger trucks and bigger machines. And when Dr. Stinson is talking about productivity, instead of having 35,000-ton trucks, they had 240,000-ton trucks. And so they were doing things on a much bigger scale, which is why the number of employees didn't come back, but the production went up. So
that gets back to my question, Dr. Stinson. What has the history been where you have, you're suggesting with taconite, productivity came back, employment did not. So what's happened with displaced workers where they don't have the jobs available to come back? Do they simply go on to more minimal jobs and then kind of fade into retirement, trying to maintain as best they can? What kind of a history do we have with that?
We don't have good history as to what happens to individual workers, and I'm not aware of really good studies, but some anecdotal information they have is that some people end up getting equivalent jobs. Some people actually end up getting slightly better jobs because they were trapped into a low benefit situation, but were still wanted to be in retaining those benefits and so on. But a significant portion of the people earn less in those in their replacement jobs. And I think the real challenge that we have is how do you reduce the dislocation time in there? How do we prepare people to how do we prepare people to have the skills needed to match where the new jobs are? And I think that's going to be a challenge, not just for this legislature, but for the next 4 or 5 years.
And have we had a situation where we've had the triple combination we have now, where you have three major sectors where there's been significant drop-off?
In the 1980s, we had, if you remember, we had a farm crisis. We had a national recession. We had problems in the lumber and wood products industry. We had, a broad array of problems. So we've had those problems before. It takes a while to evolve out of them. But at that time, the skill problem wasn't as big a problem simply because the labor force wasn't as great and people were moving in. There was more growth from people moving into the labor force, just entering the labor force where they had a set of skills already established. This time we have a situation where much of the labor force is already in place, and we're having to see big changes in the skill sets that are necessary.
Well, that you've emphasized over and over again, not just this morning, but in previous discussions with us, that that's obviously what you fear the most in terms of coming out from where we are right now in terms of what's going to be there relative to employment. And you look at the numbers, and I assume some of the budget numbers underscore this, that corporate tax collections are projected to be up. So there is an economic recovery at a certain level, but income taxes continue to diminish. And I just wonder, with the depth of this recession, whether or not we end up for a generation with some kind of permanent underclass. I don't know if it was Senator Tomasoni or Senator Metzen, I think Senator Tomasoni asked Senator Bach if the carpenters who are on the bench are ready to become X-ray technicians. And if people can't make that conversion over several years to whatever the positions are, do we have a more significant underclass than we've had before, and that's going to be a generational underclass.
Mr. Chairman, you know, that's a concern. There isn't anything guaranteed, though. With appropriate action, with appropriate guidance, people will make the right decisions. You know, for a carpenter on the bench that's 57 years old, it doesn't make it's unlikely to make economic sense to take a two-year X-ray technician training program in there. That individual is more likely to opt into something that requires less training. For somebody that's early in their career, though, they may look out and the expected present value of their earnings in having made that shift may be greater than they have, and so than if they hadn't have made that shift. And so that's kind of the issue here. And what we're trying to do is give you a heads up on an emerging problem in this situation. We've been so focused on the immediate loss of jobs, and certainly that's an important problem. But part of the recovery from this very deep, very serious recession is going to require people to make career shifts as well.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter, could you just describe for us the change in the forecast relating to the transfer that would be needed into the Health Care Access Fund, how much that changed and why?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, there's a small change in the Minnesota Care projections in this forecast, down, I think it's $11 or $12 million. Because of the interrelationship between the general fund and the Health Care Access Fund, that would reduce the transfers between those two funds by a like amount, and that is included
why was that change forecasted? What caused the change?
I believe, Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe the underlying issue here was just a slightly reduced anticipated cost of the Minnesota Care program, freeing up some resources in the Health Care Access Fund, allowing some of those transfers from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund not to take place.
Mr. Showalter, I was told that it has to do with the amount of the negotiated health plan contracts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I wasn't quite sure if it was enrollment. If you got specific information that it was on the per-person cost, I will go with you on that. I'm sorry, Senator Berglund, but it's the bottom line is the costs of the Minnesota Care program are slightly lower than previously forecast in November. That means the Health Care Access Fund has a little bit more money, but given this forecast, it still had a serious deficit requiring transfers from the general fund into the Health Care Access Fund to cover the costs of enrollment with the assumption of the auto enrollment.
Mr. Showalter, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Showalter, can you remember a time ever in the past when a forecast was based on an administrative action that was questionable at best in terms of its legality?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. This is very unique.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter, the reason I raise that issue is because we now have a forecast, and we now have dozens of budget pages based on this forecast. And I do not believe that it is of service either to the administration or the legislature. I think, you know, we're going to be sitting in my office figuring out how to untangle it. We had hoped the bill we passed on GMC would have untangled it so we could just go on, but since we're not having that bill be enacted, then we're stuck trying to unravel these pages based on, you know, something that, you know, is questionable at best as to whether it actually will ever happen.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree. The baseline at this point is very difficult. And since the human services programs have a lot of interrelationships, I agree that it is very difficult to assess what's the basis, what's the starting point for all of these proposals, since they're all fairly different.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter, do you think it would be possible for us to get budget pages that would show what these funds would be if we didn't have auto enrollment occurring?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not sure. We can certainly talk with the DHS about that. We did try to provide in this forecast additional information on both scenarios, the scenario that is included in these forecast numbers, as well as the impact of auto enrollment, the impact on the health care access fund, so that there's some information as a starting point included in this forecast right away.
Well, Mr. Showalter, I guess what I'm telling you is that whatever you've been providing us isn't really very helpful, and we really need to know what the budget pages and the forecast would look like if auto enrollment is not going to happen.
Senator Pogemiller.
Chairman, just on before I go to the question, I want to ask on page 54 where Senator Berglund was just talking, what are the options for bringing the health care access fund into balance? It's projected now to go to $844 million negative by 2013. What are the options for fixing that,
Mr. Chairman?
Because it has to be fixed, right? You can't have that thing be $1 billion in deficit.
Mr. Chair, Majority Leader, the $844 million is the forecast number. Obviously, there's a budget presentation or budget discussion that will have to take place sometime between now and 12 and 13, because that isn't a sustainable.
And what are the options for altering that number?
As you would typically expect, Mr. Chair, Senator, it would be either spending reductions, revenue increases.
What kind of spending reductions?
It would have to be reductions in either the population that would be moving in under this baseline, which would be the GAMC auto enrollment, or else Minnesota Care enrollees who are currently in the program.
And what are the options for revenue increases for that fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a couple sources of revenue in this fund. Primarily, it's talked about, there's a provider tax. There's also an HMO tax. There's also some federal funds that are included in here. So if that was extended, that would have some impact.
Okay. Then, Commissioner, I did want to go back to page 7, the planning estimate number. And I wanted to point out on page 11, the consul noted that projecting future expenditures without making allowance for inflation were required by law understate the severity of the financial problem. So that's why I think we should always be adding that 1.1 in, because the consul, your own document says that we probably should. Are we the only state that doesn't include inflation on both sides of the ledger, expenditures and revenue? Are we the only state that does that? Because it seems like we should pick one side of that. We should either not include it on the expenditure side and or on the revenue side, or put it on both sides of the ledger. What?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, it's been a while since I've looked at what other states have done. I can certainly do that.
Yeah, I think we might be the only state. But so back then to – so let's look at on page 7, that chart. And for purposes of this, we don't need to put the $1.1 billion in there. Let's just take the $5.7. You and the governor yesterday stated that really that's only $3 billion. And I was just curious how you got there. How do you get to $3
billion? Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I was essentially outlining the recommendations in our supplemental budget proposal.
What recommendations in your budget get you that to $3 billion rather than $5.7?
The moving the
it's five.
The total unallotment ratification is $2.2 billion in the tails. That counts the shift as well as the unallotted reductions made permanent. And then it's about $700 million in some change that gets you to about 2.9, and then you subtract 2.9 from 5.7. And that's how we...
So you would not pay back the shift? Because earlier in our discussion, you said you were recommending that you were going to pay back the shift. Now you're saying you get the 3 by not paying back the shift.
We are shifting. Our proposal enacts the... In fact, it's the exact same proposal that the House had, the 7327 shift, that shifts it all... and that shifts it like we normally do.
No, but to get the 5.7 down, it sounds like you have to shift it another 2 years then. Well, so it wouldn't be paid back to get the 5.7 down. You're proposing that it go out even another two more years.
Yes.
Am I correct about that?
Yes, you are.
Okay. So how many total years then is that, under that recommendation? How many total years is it that that money won't be paid back? Is that 3 or 4 years or 5 years? How many years is that?
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, it's the exact same proposal as the House proposed and what you passed at the end of session in that bill that passed on the last day.
Well, Senator Pogemiller,
actually,
I think the issue is it's beyond the planning horizon.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no plan to pay back the school shift because it's beyond the next biennium.
Yeah, and so, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, you keep saying it's the exact proposal. It's not the exact proposal that was put on the governor's desk. That's just not factually true. Even if it was, though, it's not. But even if it was, your plan is to shift it out even another 2 years now. Correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, yes.
Okay.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions are for Dr. Stinson. And, Mr. Chair, if I could just have the indulgence of just a few to really understand. If I look at page 3 of the highlights is what I have here. I read the entire thing, but I'm wondering, Dr. Stinson, the chart in our package, is that prepared by Global Insights, and those are their pessimistic baseline or optimistic projections? Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, the chart on the bottom of page 3 was actually prepared by me, but it takes the Global Insight numbers. It's just I put it into the Excel spreadsheet. And the same way with the chart at the bottom of page 4. Those are both U.S. forecasts by Global Insight.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I really wanted to find that out because I'm not at all confident in whether what's been happening over the last few years in Minnesota has been meeting with these baseline projections that we've been seeing or the pessimistic or the optimistic. But I think we should know that when it comes to the GDP, but especially when it comes to revenue projections. It'd be nice to know what's our success rate when we project out. Have we been on target with these baselines, or where do we fit in? Is there any way for you to go back to your staff and ask them to prepare some trend lines from where were we at a few years ago and what actually happened? I want to have some confidence that if we're going to budget based on your baseline projections, that we're actually going to see those circumstances, that there's some success rate there. In particular, one of my concerns, and maybe you can address this, is in the last biennium, we had $30 billion in revenues, if I remember your last forecast. And the projection at that time for 2012-2013 was $34.3 billion. And now with the February forecast, you've reduced that just a little bit to $32.9. I'm wondering on what the factors are that bring you to the conclusion that we're actually going to have $3 billion more in revenues in 2012-13 than we've had in the last biennium, and how confident are you that those factors will materialize? And when we prepare our next set of budgets, we're not setting ourselves up for yet more difficulties, more deficits, and long-term structural deficits.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, there aren't any guarantees that when we do the November forecast and do the first forecast for revenues for fiscal 2012-2013 that they will be within $1 billion of what we've said here. I mean, the crystal ball gets a little foggy really quickly, and when you're looking 4 and 5 years out into the future, it's very foggy. Still, this is Global Insight's best estimate of how the U.S. economy is going to grow, and the way that we project revenues for 2012-2013 is that we assume that Minnesota is going to grow at the same rate. The components of the tax base in Minnesota will grow at the same rate as the U.S. economy. So the U.S. economy, the the income tax base grows at 5%. We say Minnesota's income tax base is going to grow by 5%. Now, historically, Minnesota's done a little bit better than the national average. We have grown a little bit faster over history, and because of that, we have typically, but not always, the planning estimates have been a little bit pessimistic compared to what the forecast actually was. But there have been times when the economy turns down, and of course nobody knows what's going to happen to the economy in 2012 or 2013. There have been times when the economy turns down unexpectedly, and in those situations or in situations where for some reason we have a major change in capital gains behavior, the forecast is wildly optimistic compared to what actually shows up. We have a situation now where we have a lot of uncertainty, and it's not about the economy, but rather it's about behavior of individual investors with respect to realizing capital gains. Under current law, under current federal law, the capital gains tax rate changes at the end of 2010. It goes from 15% to 20%. We expect that there's going to be an acceleration of revenue of sales of capital gains into 2010 and away from 2011 and 12 and 13. The extent of that acceleration, though, while we're trying our best to model it, is really unknown. And so that adds a lot of risk both to the 2011 forecast and the 2012-2013 forecast.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your answer, but I would appreciate follow-up analysis of what our previous projections look like compared to what the accuracy, you know, what the actuality is. And I think the members of these committees are sophisticated enough to recognize that a major change sometimes is unpredictable. But I think we'd like to know, I'd like to know for sure what our accuracy or success rate has been. And I think, you know, we can interpret that, and you can come back and provide further information for us in order to help us properly identify what the trends are. But I think we rely so much at the Capitol on what you tell us is our projected revenue forecast. We make huge decisions that impact everybody's life in the state of Minnesota. And so I think it's fair for us to ask you to go back, show us where we've been, what the actuality has been, and if you're making projections, what those factors are that might distinguish us from the federal assumptions that you're adopting in your budget forecast. That way we can share that information and then act accordingly when we adopt our budget. But I think a little bit more background, a little bit more history, and more identification of these factors that you consider would be very helpful to the members of these committees.
Senator Cohen.
Dr. Stinson, let me ask something a little bit different. And over the years, I've hesitated to drag you into what at times have been political arguments, but you were quoted in the paper yesterday or this morning from yesterday's press conference as suggesting that the federal stimulus monies have allowed Minnesota to, and the country, if you said that, but I think it's only in the case of Minnesota, to come out of the recession somewhat more quickly. Now, that's obviously a paraphrase of a longer quote, but I wonder if you might be willing to comment on the impact of federal stimulus monies into Minnesota relative to the economy, and if you can, at a national level.
Mr. Chairman, it's to me it's impossible to imagine putting as much money into the economy as we have put into the economy without it having some impact on economic growth. The president, if I remember right, was saying that his stimulus package would create or save or create, maybe is a better word, way of putting it, more than 3 million jobs. He was saying that about 60,000 jobs in Minnesota would have been allocated, would have been created or saved from the stimulus package. My staff and I aren't quite as optimistic about the power of the stimulus package as that, but still our guess is that when all is said and done, about 45,000 jobs would have been saved or created because of the stimulus package. That's part of our forecast. That's embedded in our forecast in there as well.
And Dr. Stinson, this might be an unfair question because I'm not sure if I'm crossing a line or not, relative to your council. But is there any disagreement within the council on the part of economists, state economists who serve as your advisory committee?
You know, we've never asked, Mr. Chairman, we've never asked individual council members for their assessment of the number of jobs that would have been created or saved by the stimulus package. The major forecasting services that we're aware of, Global Insight, Moody's Economy.com, David Weiss at Standard & Poor's, Maury Harris at UBS, all of those have roughly the same magnitude of job creation from the federal stimulus package. Now, that's not to say that each one of those economists wouldn't have structured the stimulus package differently than the way it is, and that some individuals believe that, you know, we would have been more effective if we would have put more money into extended unemployment compensation and less money into business tax breaks. Other economists believe that if we'd have put more money into business tax breaks and less into infrastructure, we would have been more effective. But I think that all of them believe that without the federal stimulus package, and I know that Mark Zandi from Moody's Economy.com and the Global Insight forecast both said that in the absence of the stimulus package, the recession would have extended probably at least another year, that the risk that we would have gone into Great Depression number two would have been increased greatly, and that unemployment rates would be at least another percent higher than they are now. I mean, that's kind of the consensus information from economic forecasters.
Senator Ortman, I think that's part of your request of Dr. Stinson as to how accurate has Global Insight's projections been, where they assign a pessimistic or an optimistic probability. I don't know if comparing historical data is all that helpful because of things like Senator Cohen's question, because there are external factors that Global Insights may not be aware of today, whether there's another federal stimulus. It just seems like there are external factors in the future that Global Insights has no idea are going to potentially impact their scenarios. And certainly the federal stimulus money had some impact on per capita income, on GDP, that at some point back when they were forecasting, if they had known that information in the future, would have probably changed their probabilities. So I'm not sure, because of external factors, that the information's all that helpful. Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, of course, there are external factors and things change. Of course they do. But I think that it would be helpful to see what was projected and what actually happened. What were the circumstances that occurred that led us? I mean, I think most of us have a general idea, but I'd like to see what those projections are so that we don't make the same errors next time, so that next time we have a fuller understanding when we go and assume that what's being projected is what's going to be the reality. Then we all have a better common understanding of what goes into and what those external factors really could be.
Well, I think, Senator Ortman, I think the issue is it's not as easy as to just plot it on a curve. without a narrative on why we saw things happen. I mean, an example of that, I think, is the property tax trends in Minnesota. After the 2001 tax bill was passed, property taxes in Minnesota came down by about $1 billion. So if you plotted property taxes in Minnesota on a graph, all of a sudden there'd be this big reduction as a result of the 2001 tax bill. And without a narrative to go with it, it would be hard to understand what happened. And I think their forecasting and assigning probabilities are affected by the same kind of external factors. So without a narrative, I just don't think it's as easy as to just plot it on a graph.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I don't think it's easy at all. I think it's very complicated, but Dr. Stinson is an expert and his staff members are experts, and I do think that you need to have the narrative. And I also invited him back to come back and make sure we do understand what those factors were that impacted the actual numbers from what the forecast numbers were. But when the economist comes in and tells us, here's the optimistic, here's the baseline, and here's the pessimistic, I want to know, what happened? Where did we actually fit into that scenario? And I'm guessing that, I don't think it's a pretty, a difficult guess. I think most people would agree that we fell into the pessimistic or below. But I'd like to see how frequently is that happening. Are we at the optimistic in 1 year and pessimistic the next? Is it that volatile, our projections, or are they actually much more consistent on an overall long-term basis? I'd like to know that. And if we're going to start to address the structural deficit, I think we need to have that information.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Dr. Stinson some questions, and it has to do with jobs and whether jobs are more valuable or less valuable. Some people say that a job in the private sector means more than a job in the public sector. And I want to ask you about something that you said, I think you said a few months ago. I'm not sure if I remember this correctly or not, sure. But I think you said that if we cut taxes $1 billion, we may create 1,000 jobs in the private sector.
If we cut government by $1 billion, we might be losing 2,700 jobs. And my first question is, did you say something like that a few months ago? Or don't I remember that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, in late June, there was a hearing that I talked at, and I don't remember the exact numbers. Those numbers seem too disparate to me. That's too big a gap, I think. But I'd have to go back and look at the work that I did. I think I don't think it was 1,000 versus 4,600. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, what I've done is I've taken $1 billion and divided it by $50,000 of income and divided it for 20,000 jobs. $1 billion. So I don't know. But at any rate, there are people that say the private sector jobs are worth more than the public sector jobs in terms of taxes paid and and so forth. The real job there in the private sector and kind of diminish those that work in the public sector. So how do you see that? How does anybody need an education? Almost all the businesses are publicly owned or privately owned. You work at the casino, all of those are
jobs are really government jobs or tribal jobs. And is that worth less than if it was privately owned, or how do you see that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, the way that we, in the Minnesota economic model, the way that we treat tribal jobs in the entertainment business is to take them out of the public sector and put them into the private sector is part of the amusement and entertainment area. And so, our treatment in the model would say that casino worker contribution and activity on an Indian reservation is equivalent to a worker at Canterbury Downs or something like that that was being paid the same amount. So our treatment in the Minnesota economic model is consistent with what you're suggesting, which is a job is a job.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, I think you and I may agree on this. I think we all do valuable work, and I used to think raising food was a pretty important job, and so on. Some jobs are worth more than others, but it looks to me at this point in my life that all these jobs are important, and we all interface in different ways. And the guy that sweeps the floor and keeps his capital clean that's probably just as important as a job I'm doing or you're doing. And I try not to diminish anybody's contribution to our society. But there are politicians out there that do diminish those of us that work in the public sector. So what you're saying is a public sector job is just as important in terms of the economy as a private sector job. Is that correct?
What I'm saying is that the impact of losing a public sector job and the impact of losing a private sector job on the national economy are roughly equivalent, yes.
Okay, so if that's true, as we cut government, we're losing X number of jobs, and as we cut taxes, we're gaining X number of jobs, and so we're kind of in a conundrum here.
No, Mr. Chairman, no. There's a mathematical relationship, what's called the balanced budget multiplier in macroeconomics, that says that cutting government spending is more detrimental to the economy than raising taxes, because when you cut government spending, you lose that first round of spending, whereas if you raise taxes, some of the economic activity that was going on before comes out of savings, basically. And so there is a mathematical relationship.
Okay. So just one final question, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson. How much would you recommend that we raise taxes?
That's not my responsibility. That's what you get elected to do.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I look at this and I realize the paperwork that we process, it strikes me as that we should have better knowledge of the number of people that are getting unemployment, going into training programs, and otherwise those that are not on the list, if you will, that we're currently have minimal record, it seems to me, of people that are working, and we don't know that they actually are.
Not sure that's a question directed at anybody. Further questions? Comments? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to go back to the discussion that Senator Ortman was raising regarding the accuracy of certain predictions of what the economy would be, and then we as a policy maker rely on those predictions of what the economy may or may not be doing, only to find external factors messing up the direction or the projection of what happened. It's probably an eternal dilemma. Regarding economic considerations, we'll always wrestle with. However, the base assumptions that go into some of these base predictions probably shouldn't be relied on as heavily to then use it as a foundation to start building some of our major tax and spend policies. If there are, let's assume that there's always external factors that are going to come and go through our life, one biennium to another, if we're relying that as a foundation to build our tax policies on, then we're kind of on shaky ground to begin with. And as you look at some of the direction of where the federal government is going and attempting to solve the problems that we have in on an economic condition. I'm not so sure if that's necessarily the best foundation to make our assumptions on either. I guess that begs the next question is, where do we go and what do we really rely on? Now, I'm not sure what the best place is. I'm not convinced that what we've relied on in the past is necessarily the best either. Instead of making far-ranging, large sweeping changes in our tax policy, is that good at this time when the rest of the world has got rocky seas? I'm not sure. Or is it better to make small incremental changes that might give us more flexibility to react to these external factors? We could make a terrible mistake if we go too far, too fast, and then rely on some predictions that one or two external factors come along and blow the whole formula out the window. Yet our kind of ship maneuvers very slow. We can't steer it that fast. The federal government is even worse. I think we have to be very careful on how we make our assumptions, and then are we relying on it so much as a gospel fact that one external factor topples the whole formulas that we're trying to create. Certainly the state's gone through other issues like this before. What lessons have we learned from that time? During the early 1980s, we had a national economy that was faltering. What did we do to get out of that mess? It took years to get out of that mess. Being a person that was in business promoting real estate sales at that time, it was a mess that lasted almost 10 years. It's not a mess that's going to go away in 1 or 2 years. I don't think the federal government and the estimates that we have on a 1-2 year surfacing, I think it's that's extremely hopeful, but I don't think that's reality.
Well, Senator Lemire, I think the uncertainty in forecasting, I think, reinforces the fact that things like shifts need to get paid back so that somewhere in the future those kind of accounting moves are available to provide some shock absorber from the uncertainty of the revenue stream. So I do hope we come out of this session with some plan, not just some language that someday the shift will be paid back. You know, will it be 10 years, will it be 15 years? But we actually come out with a plan that not only commits in statute to pay it back, but actually commits the revenue. Because I do think the revenue needs to, because for your very reason, we need to commit the revenue to pay the shift back so that somewhere down the road, when the state slips into a revenue trough like this, that something like the school shift is available to build the bridge because of the uncertainty that you reference.
Senator Cohen. Senator Limmer, the questions from you and Senator Ortman beg the question of whether or not this legislature is proceeding on a basis where we have some trust in the numbers. First of all, your comment about what we do and how we handle in the future, maybe more Senator Ortman's question, that would take us into infinity. Then we should not do anything at any time because we can't be totally certain. But what I'm not sure is what the two of you are presenting to us relative to what kind of numbers we should rely on. I mean, Senator Limmer, I don't know, should we pick a number out of a hat? Would that be a more accurate number? Is that your suggestion? Or should we flip playing cards? What would you suggest we do, Senator Limmer?
Well, Mr. Chair, when we have unpredictable economic conditions that this country is facing now, if we look at the past history, let's say going back to the Great Depression, Minnesota went through the Great Depression with much less pain than a lot of our neighboring states. And the reason was is that it had as it, in comparison with other states, it had a diversified job base. It had a diversified economy. We were blessed with mining and manufacturing and agriculture at that time. We are in a far different position now than what our historical past had been during economic crisis. We do not have the robust mining operation going on as we did then. We do not have the manufacturing. That has left the state essentially. Much of it is going overseas, and other times it's going to other states. I think we need to look, at least for our state, we have to, if we're going to start relying on prognostications that now are being discussed as being, are they as accurate as they once were? Can they ever be accurate? I'll give that as a fair argument, because there are external factors that come along from time to time. But I think if we're going to be making shifts in what we do to spur on the economy, we've got to start recognizing the historical aspects of where we were and where we are now. We are not in the same position as we once were. We now are shifting more to a service-oriented economy, not relying on manufacturing, not relying on mining. And I don't think our tax policies are reflecting the current status of where our jobs are in the state. Our tax system is recognizing the past, and we're not recognizing the present, and I don't think we're mapping out a direction of where the future is either. I think we need to start really looking at where the state has been and where it's going, and I think we're in completely different worlds. So where do we go from now? I think we have to look at our state the way it really is and understand where do we get our jobs and where are we going?
Well, that's what we've been hearing from these three gentlemen for the last year consistently. So it's our job then. They've posed the question and presented to us. Mm-hmm. I know what Dr. Stinson just talked about was productivity. In the past he's talked, and today has talked about retraining. Senator Bach, you've got major legislation that does some of that. I remember in 2001, in a time of surplus, Senator Kelly and I had a major proposal relative to in terms of investment and in terms of high tech that was not approved by the then House representatives, by the then governor. We passed it off the Senate floor. Senator Bach, you've got legislation this year, I think along with Senator Metzen, that tries to take a look at that, to look to a new economy. And I don't know if you have Senator Limmer as a co-author on the bill, but it sounds like he'd be very interested.
Senator Limmer, are you making the argument if we're moving towards a service-type economy for an expansion of the sales tax, as more dependence on the sales tax and maybe less on income, or what's the argument if you said our tax system is outdated?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the state of Minnesota needs jobs. I don't think it's been growing in a robust way. That's debatable, of course. But I believe that much of our job picture and the failure to have adequate number of jobs for our state is based on how we're treating business in the state of Minnesota. I believe when you have close to 20-some states that don't even have corporate income tax, and on top of it, they're in southern climates that attract businesses there, I don't think our answer has been we provide lots of these little tax credits for individual industries. We've been doing it for 30, 40 years. We've had 30, 40 years, I think, of moderate, if anemic, success in developing job development in the state of Minnesota. I think we need a wholesale reform of the entire tax structure in the state of Minnesota. I think nothing is going to get us to the robust growth of jobs until we do that. And we just keep nibbling around the edges. And we rely on prognostications that reflect a pessimistic and an optimistic view. And then all we get is a wide range of what it might just be. And then on top of it, we have one external factor that blows that all apart. I think we're relying on the wrong numbers. I think we need to start doing a forward proactive approach to tax policy as well as job development. That I believe is a tide that will raise all boats. And I think that should be the goal of what we do in the state. And I don't think it has been going in that direction for not only many years, but a number of decades.
Mr. So, Senator Limmer, you think the budget forecast as presented by the Department of Finance is something we should not rely on? That's what you just said?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I can rely on it or not. Senator Ortman asked to see a depiction of the forecast versus reality in the past, and we haven't gotten any assurance that we can get that either. So I don't know what we should rely on if we can't compare the reports that we've relied on in the past. We still have a problem. Now it's being claimed that it's external factors. I don't know if that's accurate or not. I'd like to do my own homework on it. I think Senator Ortman and I are asking for some comparisons, and we don't even get the courtesy of an answer saying yes or no, we could get that.
A courtesy of an answer from whom?
Well, we asked some of the people at the table.
Well, ask the commissioner. It's his job. The commission.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, it's interesting discussion when this is, as I think Dr. Stinson will tell you, this is probably as close as you're ever going to get, at least on the revenue predictions. There's an inherent, the longer and farther out you predict, there's an inherent, it's difficult to look out. That's why they're called planning estimates.
You know, Senator Limmer, I was, to the commissioner's point, I was just amazed. There was all this uncertainty in the depth of a deep recession, what the holiday season was going to bring in revenue. And I remember in January when we got the actual revenue collection numbers from November, December, they were $1 million off. $1 million. I mean, it was like perfect. So, I'm not sure. I think Commissioner Hansen's probably right. I think we're doing the best we can. It's why it's called a forecast. And Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to remind Senator Cohen of some work that came out of a commission that he was instrumental in establishing, the Long-Term Budget Trends Study Commission, where we actually looked at the volatility of the tax base over an extended period of time and have, you know, extensive report on it that's received some national attention as well in terms of which revenue sources are more volatile and the trade-offs that you have between revenue growth and revenue volatility. That study also recommended a much larger budget reserve because of the inherent volatility that you have. One way of protecting against unforeseen downside shocks is through the budget reserve as opposed to trying to choose the lowest number possible. Second, Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to be unresponsive to Senator Ortman or Senator Limmer. I actually have here with me some information on the error in the forecast. What they're requesting, though, was something that we hadn't thought about yet, and that is if you go back and you look 5 years out into the future, what's the year? What we have, what we thought was the appropriate information to have in terms of the accuracy of the forecast was the error from the first forecast to the actual numbers that were there, and I have that information with me. The error on that is about 2.9% in there. And so that's within a pretty small margin, I would say. Looking out 5 years into the future, we haven't done that, in part because there's no statutory requirement that the legislature balance the budget structurally in the tails. That's a goal, but but that's not necessarily a
requirement. And Mr. Chairman and Dr. Stinson, it might be a little bit beside the point in terms of past history, but Senator Ortman's talked about external factors that come along unexpectedly. Senator Lemmers made the same reference. And obviously you've had some significant discussion with our committees and private discussions where clearly the combination of the subprime crisis as the first tip-off when realtors were tossing around mortgages like candy around this country for X number of years came to a head, coupled with the seizure of the credit markets as being economic cataclysms that were not predicted by any economist in the country.
Mr. Chairman, could I just follow up on my comments to Senator Limmer? I would be remiss if I didn't say, and I think where he was going, the governor's constitutional amendment that he always talks about would base spending for the current biennium on the revenues from the last biennium, and you get a little more certainty that way. And I think that's where he might have been going.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, so the commissioner doesn't put words in your mouth. Is that where you were going?
Well, with all due respect to the commissioner, no, I wasn't going in that direction.
Oh, I was just getting ready to go there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm having a hard time getting recognized here, and everyone has been speaking for me. So maybe I could do that for a change. I'm not asking Dr. Stinson for a better forecast than the one you've just given us. I would never criticize what you've given us. What I'm asking for is the historic, the background. Say 4 years ago, what were we projecting and how did we turn out and what were the factors that affected the change from your forecast to what the actuals are? And I know that you have that information and maybe just assembling it would be helpful. If I went back through each of your forecasts that you've provided us, I probably could do it, but I don't have the staff to do it that you do. And I think that it would be helpful for all of us. Mr. Chair, and to Senator Cohen's point, we have these forecasts that come in at optimistic, baseline, or pessimistic. And I don't know which ones we've adopted over time, but I think we do have to be more conservative, not politically conservative, but fiscally conservative in our budgeting. And I think that we have been very aggressive, honestly, taking optimistic numbers and budgeting in that way. I do not support the governor's constitutional amendment. I think that goes too far. But I do think if we're going to get better at this, and I hope everybody agrees we should be trying to get better at our budgeting, one of the ways to do that is to go back and say, what were those lessons learned, as Senator Limmer has said it? And then if we are going to adopt a more fiscally conservative budget, it would be to allow us to be more agile going forward, that we didn't spend down our reserves, that we built up our reserves, that we followed the recommendations of the commission that said, don't always rely on the most volatile taxes that we have. Right now, we know that income taxes are very volatile, sales taxes not so much. They might be regressive, but I think that's where I'd like to see our committees having a discussion about how do we get to a more stable budget, one that's more fiscally conservative on behalf of the residents, so that we don't have the volatility, we don't have deficits, we don't have surplus deficit. We have to get past that. And I think that's the job of these committees to do that. And I'm just asking for more information that would inform us about what are the risks, what are those types of things that come along that have been happening to us that we maybe haven't factored in when we've adopted our budget. That's all I'm asking for, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Ortman, you know, the governor appointed the 21st Century Tax Commission that reported to us last spring, I believe, and one of their recommendations was the governor's own hand-picked commission. Recommendations were we should expand the sales tax to some things and cut the rate. And the governor in his budget didn't propose that. So I think it appears this governor is not going to propose any of the tax reform that I think probably all of us in this committee think we should consider.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, that's perhaps through 2010, but we are looking at projections into 2013. And there are going to be a lot of us members coming back next year to look at these issues. There may be new members. And I think assembling some of this information so we can take the state in a new direction when the time is appropriate is what we should be doing.
Senator Pogemiller.
Commissioner, I would hope you would provide that information to Senator Ertman. I take it the governor is still pressing his constitutional amendment. Is that correct? I took from his comment yesterday that he still would like us to consider that.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Senator Bach, I would encourage you to take it up in your committee. I actually have been preparing some information regarding that. And I would love to have a discussion with the author and the executive branch on that issue, because I think it would be a good discussion.
Senator Pogemiller, when we discussed that issue here on December 7th, I had indicated publicly then to Senator Kolk that once the bill was introduced, we would have a hearing on it and have a discussion on it. I'm told by staff that it was just recently introduced.
Oh, great.
So there is a bill. I'll check with Senator Kolk and see, you know, at her convenience when we can have a hearing on it, and would hope that the governor's staff is ready to come make their presentation as to why it's a good idea going forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Commissioner, is that something you will come to discuss with us?
Myself or Commissioner Innes. I'm guessing it'll probably be me.
Could be both. I'd like to have you both here for it.
Okay. Are you making that request of me, Senator?
I would love to see you both here.
Okay, I'll have them come.
Because it's an important issue, and I think it deserves the discussion at the commissioner level, so I think it would be great to have both commissioners.
Okay.
I would love to have the governor come and discuss it with us, if that would be possible.
Okay.
Would you
I'll
make
tell
that
Ward
request?
You asked for.
Would you make that request to the governor?
I certainly will. I'll see him shortly.
Commissioner, I understand the governor's reluctance to want to sit at the committee table and not have the amount of control he normally would want to have. So maybe if the governor would come, I'd be willing to give him the gavel and he could control the discussion. if that might make him more comfortable that he'd have a little more control over the hearing, I'd be happy if the governor was willing to come and talk about the amendment. I'd be willing to give him the gavel for the day and he could control the flow.
President Obama has been more than happy to engage in those kinds of forums.
All right. But he made sure he had all the
Mr.
time
Chair,
he wanted
can we have beer?
Well, don't you remember that exchange?
Very gracious of you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything Senator Rest would like to know if we're done yet?
It's just the hardcore who's here. I think we're done, aren't we?
Commissioner,
Chairman,
anything further to add?
No, but just a thank you to you, Mr. Chairman, and the Finance Chair for consolidating your hearing. The three of us really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. This committee's adjourned.
Consolidating the plan.